Here we go. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the biweekly IRSA meeting. Please follow the code of conduct and don't violate the antitrust policy. With that being said, let's get started. Does anybody have any pull requests they want to talk about?
I'm pretty sure Lavesh does.
There are three pull requests. Two are RFCs. One is the code for those two RFCs. So I'm talking about the, so we remember we had the Sigma protocol thing. So I narrowed it down to just proof of committed elements and vector commitment. So it's now, it's not even an interface now. It's just a code that you can simply use if you're using like these groups, G1 or G2. So there is code for them, and the code is part of another PR, and the how the code supposed to be used, that's part of this RFC. And then there is another RFC for the PS signatures, where I'm basically documenting the API that is used for like used to generate signature, verify signature, or create a proof knowledge of signature and unverify that. The RFC mentions the additions that I've made, like the minor cryptographic additions, I would say, and then there's implementation optimizations that are there also. But yeah, that's it about that RFC for PS signatures. And then there's one more the code PR, which is IRSA, and that's contains the code for these two RFCs. That's it.
Okay. Is there anyone in particular you would like to name and shame to review your PRs?
Everybody. Everybody's at least who's on the call. And again, I understand like some people might not have time, but yeah. I think I've requested the review explicitly from whoever I can remember, like on GitHub. But yeah, anybody who wants to.
Yeah, and the idea with the RFCs is that all of the maintainers review them, so it shouldn't be ambiguous to any of us whether or not we need to look at it.
Okay.
Well, some of the RFCs have sat there for a long time, and I don't think it's because they're open debate. It's just that some of the maintainers are not looking at them or saying approved or changes requested. Or so who do we need to nudge?
I think I'm talking about the RFC for the verifiable encryption.
That one. There's the encryption API. One just sat there for a very long time with no comment or anything. So, I mean, how do we rustle the trees?
Yeah, I kind of wonder if maybe what we need to do is start setting more of like a project plan for IRSA and make sure that we get everybody on board, and then we've got deadlines for some of these things and priorities. That way maybe it's a little bit more organized and everybody knows, all right, well, in order to hit this milestone for the project, we really need the encryption API agreed to, and it's a priority for everybody. Otherwise, yep. It's always just kind of a one-off thing for people.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Okay, how about we make a goal to release 0.20 of IRSA by the end of September? And that has the non-creds 2.0 code in it, which includes this verifiable encryption by Lavesh. It'll have my BBS Plus signature, which I'm going to be submitting later this week, the PS signature, and some of that stuff. That gives us just a little over a month to review it, to get all of that in. Does that sound reasonable?
Yeah.
I don't know if it sounds reasonable or not. I want to say it sounds reasonable. But
I'm a reasonable guy, Dan. So
it's probably reasonable. I just don't want to give you an empty, yeah, that's reasonable. So maybe if we can just kind of sketch up those things that you just said and post them onto the wiki, and then we can either ratify that over email in the coming week or ratify it at the next meeting.
Okay, I'll write it up today then.
Yeah, that sounds perfect.
In the channel. Does that sound good?
Yeah.
And if anybody else wants to add something, then that's fine, but they need to make sure they're the one doing the work, not we hope this gets in there by somebody.
Yeah. That sounds great. And I mean, I put this on the meeting agenda. One of the things I'd like to do, and I'm willing to write this, is a hash and PRP interface.
What was the second one?
Pseudorandom permutation. In other words, AES.
Oh, okay.
So just like symmetric encryption.
How is that different than the encryption API?
It's just a lower level primitive, really.
Okay.
Or, I mean, alternatively, we could just modify the encryption API. I'm fine. If we add hash functions to that too, that's totally fine. But we need a more consistent hash API somewhere. And we need, like, a lot of people use AES as a pseudo-random permutation and not necessarily as an encryption thing. So if that makes sense. There are some applications where you basically want to use AES instead of SHA for things that you might typically use SHA for. And in this case, you're just using AES as a primitive rather than like actually doing encryption.
What did they use for the key then?
I mean, they just pick a random key and fix it, right?
Okay.
Yes.
So, I mean,
it's like a salt.
Well, it's like a salt. So it's just a random value, right? You're just using it to generate randomness. So.
Okay.
So anyway, I'll do some work on that. I don't know where we want to put it. But
should go in a separate one. I mean, the hashing should go in a separate one. The PRF should go in the PRP should go in a separate one. Maybe the PRP would be a small, very small one.
Yeah, I mean, these are both going to be pretty small, right? I mean, I think unless I'm mistaken, you know, we're only going to need like 256 bit and 512 bit hashes. And probably 128 and 256 bit PRP interfaces. And the interfaces for these are going to be really straightforward, right?
Mm-hmm. I think we had an interface somewhere in ZMix, but that was for PRF, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's see. But yeah, I think you're right over there that these two values sound good.
So, anyway. Yeah.
Before we go down the hashing interface thing, Rust already has a really nice one called Digest.
Okay.
So we could just say, if you're going to code any hashing algorithms in URSA, please use this interface that's already been defined.
Does it allow? I need to look into this. Can you post a link?
Yeah.
Does it allow like modular switching in and out?
Yeah, it's just an interface, but they've already got like 10 or 20 hashes already use it.
Oh, then why would we rebuild? I mean, if that already exists, we should probably just use that, right?
Right, but it would be nice to say we use this one, and then they've also got an extensible output hash, you know, for like Shake or, you know, HKDF. They've got an interface for that. So that's been pretty much defined by the Rust crypto team, and I quite like them.
Okay, well, yeah, let's just use that then. Can you post the link to this, Mike?
Yeah, I'm getting it now.
One of the things that we wanted with the hash abstraction is that, well, I guess what we don't want is there's different places in the code now where specific hash functions are imported. So we want to make that more abstract and consistent. That way we can swap out like a SHA-2 implementation for like an optimal one or a more secure one or whatever.
So if you look at how I did that for the Bitcoin one, it just says anything that implements a 256-bit output and the digest trait can be used. So when you call it, you just say, I want SHA-256, but you could easily swap out any other one.
Yeah, Dan, you're totally right. We want to get rid of as many hard calls to hash functions in the code as possible. So except for cases where you know, specifically have to use a certain hash function for some weird reason, the less we have dependencies, the better.
Yeah, and I think Dan Anderson had a plan to go through and clean those up and link in the right or provide easy way to link in, like in it was the OpenSSL one. There was one that was more optimized than some of the others. But anyway, I think he's been pulled onto some emergency projects. We might not see him for the rest of the year.
Okay. That's too bad.
Yeah.
By the way, how far are we looking into the future with these interfaces? Are there any differences, or would there be any differences if we add post-quantum stuff, or like these interfaces should be good? Or the hashing, like, yeah, the PRF or the PRP or the hashing interface that we want to design, would there be significant differences between the post and pre-quantum one?
Sorry, would you say, Lavesh?
My question is, when we design those interfaces, the hash, let's say the hashing one, would there be a difference in the interface that we need for the post-quantum versus the pre-quantum?
For
right
hashes?
Now, for hashes.
No, so there are no known attacks on existing, like, SHA or AES. The only difference is you could possibly use Grover's algorithm or a similar algorithm to attack more efficiently. So really, the takeaway for symmetric key crypto with quantum computers is you just need to double the key size.
Okay. So double, like, we'll use SHA-512 and then we get a like a same security, yeah, as SHA-256 and post one. Okay.
Yeah, the idea is
what Hart's trying to say is that the interface should simultaneously support quantum and non-quantum.
Yes, right. But I know
that was a quantum joke, a little superposition joke. Forced it in there.
Yeah, we should be able to use the same interface, Lavesh. We just need to make sure that we can support, you know, various different output sizes. And I'm looking at the digest stuff right now. It looks like that should be fine because you can set an output size parameter.
Okay.
Dan, I got your joke, but there's a couple times when somebody makes a joke, but it's profound enough that people scratch their heads going, oh, he's right, and then they forget that it's a joke.
Yep. I was reading an article about bad puns earlier, so I'm just going to be on that kick today. It's actually on NPR.
You're always on that kick. Like, come on now.
I just wanted an excuse.
Okay, well, thanks for the digest stuff, Mike. I guess, do they have a similar thing for like an AES style function or not?
They're working on it, but no, they don't yet.
They don't have
it for key exchange either, like a common interface, but Dalloc libraries have. What I mean is, like, how are you handling the objects? Are you just returning byte arrays? Are you encapsulating them in Rust structures? And what's the most common way to do that? So Dalloc libraries look quite nice for that, but no, the Rust crypto team hasn't standardized that yet. They do have some encryption ones, but no, there's no common API.
Okay. And is this
especially for AEAD, huh?
Yeah, and is this digest going to be One thing I'm worried about is that it might be clunky to use within other cryptographic protocols. Do you think that will be a problem or not?
No.
Okay. All right.
No, there's a lot of traits in there. Digest is just a collection of them, so you just pick the ones that suit you, suit what you need.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, in that case, why don't we can just move all the PRP stuff. I'll just edit the encryption API or something. And we can put the PRP stuff in there.
Sounds good.
I guess my motivation is there are like a lot of like, and some of the blockchain stuff, there are a bunch of like random AES calls, and we need to give people a way to handle that modularly. So.
Yeah, I'm not at all familiar with this PRP thing, but
if
it's not intended to be used as encryption, then maybe it shouldn't be in the encryption API.
I think of it as a relaxed encryption algorithm. You're still using an encryption algorithm, but you're not using it for encrypting data. You're using it to just generate random data.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Yeah. So if it's intended to be used like a pseudo random number generator, then that seems like the appropriate interface. And it's sort of a detail that underneath the hood, it's using what looks like a block cipher.
The just question is whether we want to have another very small interface document, or we want to roll it in the encryption one.
So this might help you. Rust has a very good random number generator interface already. And so you could just say, we're going to just use that.
Yeah, but you can't use that in line because that's not going to give you the same properties as a PRP. Right. The point is people are using calls to like AES or things, right? We don't want them to have to re-architect their code. We just want them to be able to change a line.
Can you give an example of where this is being done?
I'm not going to be able to find it live in the meeting. I can try to follow up. But it's...
I'd like to know the use cases.
Yeah, I mean, that sounds like a good mail list thing. Hey,
yeah, I'll follow up on this. But yeah. The basic idea is that like AES is a lot faster than SHA. Anyway, I'll follow up on this. And we can move on to talk about something else.
Okay. I think we might have skipped over the maintainer summit.
Yes.
Yeah. So we want to get together the maintainers from all of the projects. This year we've had a number of events that have been targeted at recruiting new users or new developers, but we'd kind of gotten away from some of the hackfests that we've done in the past where we got core contributors together. And so this maintainer summit is meant to go to sort of that end of the spectrum of let's get the maintainers from all of the projects in the same room or same small set of rooms. And we can work on some cross-project things and just develop more familiarity amongst all the maintainers. And sometimes that results in more cross-project work. Better than just trying to directly set up projects. Now for the second-ish week of October, that will be in Minneapolis. We moved it to that week so as not to conflict with it's an identity conference that some of you are at.
IAW?
Yeah. Yeah, so we moved it to accommodate that so that there wouldn't be a conflict there. So I'm hoping that most of you, if not all of you, can all the maintainers here can make it to that summit in Minneapolis. And then since some of you are also maintainers of other projects, if you want to help advertise that to the rest of your other projects, that would be great. And then we can get a good big group of maintainers together. This will also be an opportunity for us from an URSA perspective to interact with the projects that we want to consume URSA. Any questions on that?
Can I request that we ban talks?
That we ban what?
Talks.
Ban talks, yes. Yes, it's intended not to have PowerPoint and that kind of thing. Like, I don't want to say that we shouldn't have any, because if somebody has like a cross-project idea that they want to throw up, I think that would probably be worthwhile. But we're definitely not going to do what we did in Hackfests, where each project goes and gives like a lightning talk or a pitch for the project. There's just not an audience to hear that anyway.
So great. That's perfect.
Yeah. Well, anyway, the link to the wiki page for the event is there. It's thin right now because we haven't started putting together content for it, but it will be sort of unconference like the other ones have been. And we're also going to try to have some fun team building kinds of things going on too. All right.
Yeah, sounds good. Thanks for organizing, Dan.
So I promised in the last meeting to give a little overview of EPID, and so I can do that now. Is there a way I can share my screen? Oh, right there.
Can you take control? You should be able to.
All right, can you see my screen?
Yeah.
Okay, so I don't have a ton to look at, but I thought it might be nice to look at something besides just digging right into the paper. And so I thought, this is how I think of papers. I don't know if other people do this, but I kind of think of their genealogy. So you can think of it as the references section from the papers, like what are the main ones that are building the new paper. And so the history here is something like I think up here you'd have CL signatures, and those were a feeder to creating direct anonymous attestation, which was a protocol designed to be used in trusted platform modules. And the idea with that is that this little platform module could send out attestations about measurements that it took of the system or other things. And because these devices were intended to go out in personal computers, whoever was creating that wanted to have a lot of privacy capabilities around it.
Yeah, it's Jan Kamanish's protocol.
Yep. Yeah, so it was created by Kamanish, Burkell, and Chen, I want to say. And the features of it were really important because people didn't want like a tracking number on your computer. And that was all good, but it did lack... because it was so focused on privacy, it had a pretty limited revocation capability. And there the idea was if somebody cracked a TPM and they got the private key out of it, and that private key was then posted on like a hacker list or something, then the issuers or the whoever's relying on the integrity of those TPMs could then revoke that private key. But it's only in that case where it gets widely advertised. So Burkell and I don't know, maybe Lee. I'm not sure who the authors were for this paper besides Ernie Burkell. They wanted to add better revocation abilities. And so what the first draft of, or the first EPID protocol did was it added signature-based revocation. Now, if you had an actor that did something bad enough to catch notice with a signature, you could revoke that key through the signature. And it's, I think it's a little bit limited what that means for the signature, but we can talk about that more in a little bit. Then, as Lavesh pointed out last time, BBS Plus came along. And so it was a lot more efficient to be able to do these things with pairings. And so Burkell and Lee then published a version of EPID that used pairings. And that paper, I think, pointed at Bredow-Narrig curves and set up the constructions around those. But it's sort of abstract from the exact pairing that you would use, other than the fact that, hey, this is going to use pairings and that's going to make it more efficient. And so I think this came up in my mind in the last meeting because there's similarities with the Anand Kreds work, with Anand Kreds 2 specifically. And so I thought we'd see if there were things that were already invented for these out of this purpose that could be leveraged there, or just have some discussion about the similarities. And there might be good reasons to have differences, or there might be good reasons to adopt something that's available in EPID.
It's my understanding that EPID mostly just does anonymous attestation for one attribute. Now, I don't know if it could be expanded further than that, but that's my understanding of it.
Yeah, that's right. So it's designed to enroll a single credential or a single private key and then provide the attestations based on that. So you can think of it like a group key scheme. Similarly, you can also think of it like an anonymous credential, but I think you're right. It's really designed around a single term.
But one thing with this revocation is, so I think you can extend this to have multiple attributes, like a credential with multiple attributes, because BBS Plus supports that. But the thing is if you have a if you have a signature, which means if you have any in our non-creds land, if you have a proof from the TPM owner, the issuer or the revocation authority in that case can de-anonymize the approver, right, or the TPM. But we don't always want that. We want that to be explicit when you're, so the approver, the whoever has a TPM, the TPM should know that the signature it is making can de-anonymize it. And if he wants to, he should be able to make a signature that cannot de-anonymize it. So that's why we have verifiable encryption as a separate predicate. And if the approver is satisfying that predicate, he knows that he can be de-anonymized with someone, by certain authority. But usually he's not. So if you create a proof, the issuer and the verifier colluding cannot look at the proof and find out which holder it was. And that is not the case with EPID, right? Or the signature.
EPID's like a group signature. That, to me, BBS Plus and EPID serve two different purposes. So EPID would be good if I want like a group signature and I want to be able to, like Lavesh said, de-anonymize and revoke someone that's in the group.
So EPID doesn't let you directly open a signature. So it's unlike group key schemes where the issuer has access to the private key or a way to open the signature.
Right, but they can still know who it's from.
Not really. So the way this, I don't know if this is readable. Let me see if I can skim to the right part of the paper here. Pretty much what the gist of it is this term-ish kind of thing here. There's this optional base name. And the idea with a base is that you might have a relationship with a credit card company and a hospital, and you don't want to link between those two relationships, but you might still want to have a consistent relationship, a consistent credential with each of those parties independently. So this is exactly the same thing as the link secret, is this F term. And then when you take this base, which would be like, this is the some number that I'm going to always associate with a credit card company, for example. And then I have something that's kind of like a signature or a public key or something that's associated with that one entity. Now, if I misbehave with that entity and they say, this guy is violating something and he needs to be revoked, what goes on the signature revocation list is this term. So it doesn't completely...
Which term?
Kick out this K term.
Okay, but this K term would be different for each verifier or each relation that I have, right?
Right. Right.
Okay, so for each, let's say I have two relations. So let's say you have a TPM Alice, and then you have like two verifiers, Bob and Karen. So Alice TPM has two signatures that he uses that. One he uses with Bob and one he uses with Carol, or is just one signature?
So I think I tracked what you're saying. There'd be two different signatures, and then, yeah.
Okay, then I'm actually really confused on what's the benefit, because we had this problem, a similar problem where we had to track across for a single verifier if the same credential holder is interacting, and we solved in a slightly different way without using much fancy cryptography, like with any credential. But here I think you're saying something different then.
Yeah, I guess one thing I should have brought up that's a similarity here is that as we go further into the protocol, when you're actually constructing a signature, so up here we start the sign part of the protocol, and one of the things that you do in a signature is you include a proof that your terms aren't in this revocation list. There's two revocation lists, just to make it complicated. There's one revocation list that's still based on a private key. So if you float your private key out there for some reason, there's still a private key based revocation list. That's sort of the easy one. The slightly more complicated one is this signature-based revocation list. And so you prove non-revocation, mm-hmm. which is, I think, the same thing that you guys want to do in a non-creds too, right?
Right.
Similarly, yes.
Yeah.
Not quite the same, but the same idea, yes.
Yeah.
But then just one question again. So basically, the revocation authority, if finds out the signature, so this TPM is making those signatures, right? So whenever the TPM interacts, whatever the statement is or whatever the action is, TPM makes a signature on that and sends the signature out to the whatever party it's interacting with, right?
Right, to a verifier, yeah.
Yeah, to a verifier. And there is one entity in the system, you call it issuer or revocation authority or whoever, but that can, once it has a signature, it can always de-anonymize the TPM.
No. All it can do is, so I think it's the protocol is designed so that you've got a revocation authority, but that could be the same as the issuer if you wanted. But either way, what that entity can do, the person or the entity that controls this revocation list, all they can do is put these base name signature pairs, or base public key, however you want to think of that term. This K term is what incorporates the link secret.
Okay.
So it's never able to actually expose the identity of the signer. All I can do is say that signatures from the signing relationship between a particular signer and a particular verifier are now revoked.
Okay, and if you look at two signatures, can you find the scale would be different across these two signatures?
The K would be different across two verifiers, but I think with the same verifier, you would end up with the same K and the same B.
So when a so you have a when a K is revoked, so let's say I make a signature with this deepin called Alice, he makes a signature, sends a signature to Bob. Now Bob takes K1 and asks the revocation authority to revoke it. So K1 is revoked. And now when Alice makes a signature for K for Carol, K2 is made. Now at this point, does Carol consider Alice revoked by looking at the revocation list or not?
I don't think so. If I was tracking what you're saying, so try to draw some of this. So if so, let's say Alice is our signer. Mm-hmm. Is that what you're saying?
Yes. Okay.
And then we've got Bob. Is a verifier, and Carol. Mm-hmm. I think that's how you spell Carol. So then this would be KB, let's say, and this would be K sub C,
mm-hmm.
and the revocation list we're saying would have KB on it.
Okay.
And so once Bob says that this person who he doesn't know as Alice should be revoked, then that key goes on the list. But when Alice is interacting with Carol, Alice is not revoked.
Then, like, what does revocation mean, really? Because what he say, revoking it only, prevents Alice from ever interacting with Bob, but he can always interact with Carol or a different person, right? Different verifier.
Yeah.
Wait, so why is Bob's key on the... Bob is just verifying. Why is he being revoked?
He's not. So when Alice talks to Bob, she is signing using a pseudonym. Maybe that's the way to think of it.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Sorry.
Dissociated. Yeah, well, it's not yet a very...
Love the diagram, though. It's
so the thing that Alice has that lets it make signatures, like, does Alice have two things or one credential that we call anonymous credentials from the TPM company or whatever?
She has enrolled with the... Yeah, so there's one issuer that I could put on here, and the issuer
so you have this provisioner that's provisioning the TPMs, and then like that's it gives it one thing, one credential, and then Alice can interact with any number of verifiers using that credential, and whenever he interacts with it, he creates this new key, a new K.
Yeah, so the issuer gives a signature over F, which is, I don't know if it's confusing if I subscript it like that, but so Alice's secret, her link secret is F sub A.
Mm-hmm.
And so the issuer never sees F. It, basically the, I think a protocol that's familiar is...
Yeah, you can sign a commitment.
Signature.
That's fine. Yeah, it's a line signature on F and... you move ahead, but let's say Alice has a signature, right? Now, really, not, what you're guarding against is an adversary who has broken into this Alice TPM and should not be should not be allowed to interact with any verifier or create signatures for any create valid signatures for any verifier, right? That's what you want to prevent.
There's some background noise here. I think what you were asking is you want to make sure that if Alice does something bad with Bob, you might want to revoke Alice from all,
yes,
interact with all verifiers.
Yes.
And I don't think that this protocol lets you do that.
Okay.
With just the signature-based revocation, there's also the, I don't remember what they call it, but it's basically like the secret, the link secret-based revocation.
The private key-based revocation?
Yeah. So yeah, that would include, so let's say that she's exposed her key somehow, then you revoke her from everybody.
Okay. Then it's, yeah, then, I mean, this doesn't seem...
Actually, I may have misspoken. So I think she has to prove that when Alice goes to interact with Carol, I think that her proof of non-revocation has to be over the entire list. So I think she has to generate a proof for every B and K pair on that list.
Okay, now this makes sense. This seems useful, but I think the way you're saying it, probably that might be slightly incorrect, because there's no way somebody can imagine. So if you look at the essence of what we do in non-quits revocation, you're really, Alice, kind of proving that without revealing FA, without revealing the FA to issuer or to Bob or to Carol, Alice is proving that FA is not in the, or some commitment to FA is not in the revocation list, right? And then whenever Alice creates this KB, it shows that KB is a commitment to FA, and the FA inside KB is not there in the revocation list. So that's kind of on a very high level, that's what happens in a non credentials, and I think that's what happens here also.
Yeah, and so as I'm thinking through this, I think you can probably set up a variety of policies. So I'm pretty sure, after talking out loud here, that if you revoke, if Bob causes Alice to be revoked through this KB pseudonym, mm-hmm, then Alice can no longer prove to Carol that Alice is not on this signature revocation list. So you could then have any one of these verifiers kick Alice out of the entire system. But then I can also imagine that Bob could just operate his own revocation list, and Bob only cares whether Alice is revoked with Bob, and Carol doesn't care about Bob. She's cruel and heartless like that. And so she would just maintain her own signature-based revocation list. So you could probably come up with any sort of hybrid of policies.
Yeah.
One thing that I didn't get a chance to look more into was I've got this dotted line from the Kamena Shoup, because in here there's this very cryptic statement, which is the right kind of statement to put in a crypto paper, that we can just use this protocol from the Kamena Shoup paper, which I'm really not quite sure what that means specifically, because if of course, it can't really refer to, you know, this is sort of RSA based or PIA based.
You should be able to use the same protocol with elliptic curve elements also, right?
Because I don't know what they mean, because like I didn't get a chance to dig into the CS paper more, but it talks about like a sigma protocol, which is pretty high level. So I don't know what he's alluding to here.
No, but this 21 paper is the same as the verifiable encryption paper, right? That we had RSC for, correct?
The Kamena Shoup thing is the verifiable encryption, yeah.
Okay, so I think it's talking the same one, but that's, no, now I get it. So he is basically, I think what it's doing, it is basically doing a verifiable encryption, like this paper is doing a verifiable encryption unconditionally, like for any signature it is making, it's doing a verifiable encryption of its identity that the revocation authority is somehow able to open up. So it might not be doing its private key, putting the private key in there, but something else in there that kind of links back to the the TPM. That's what I can think of in this description.
Yeah, so it's got a pseudonym that's connected with a link secret,
or something that with the thing that the signature that comes from the issuer, or the credential that comes from the issuer, or the provisioner. So something that lets uniquely point out to a TPM. So okay, so that, now on a high level again, you can say that the kind of credential that we are going to have in Anonymous 2.0, they are doing a verifiable encryption. Is optional. You can or you cannot do. The revocation doesn't depend on the verifiable encryption done. But I think in this one, the revocation does depend on the verifiable encryption being done.
You're saying that in EPID, you think it's connected with verifiable encryption?
Yeah, I think so. I'll read and probably tell you in like next one or two days, but I think that might be the case.
Yeah, there's nothing to my knowledge that ever lets an issuer or anybody else open anything. So that's why I'm not sure what he's taking from Kamena Shoup, because if it's just a Sigma protocol, that's not specific enough to build this out. I guess the two avenues of exploration I have are to take through Kamena Shoup and see just see which protocol. The problem is, like, if you search for protocol in that paper, you get like every other sentence includes the word protocol. So
okay, I might be wrong then. I might be wrong because you have this inequality, right? So Kamena Shoup paper has the proof of inequality of discrete logs. So I think it might be the this inequality sign there. Because, yeah, this paper has I think in last section, maybe halfway down the paper, they have this proof of inequality of discrete log. So that mm-hmm. might be it. So that might be it. Yeah, that's what they're probably using.
Oh, in the EPID paper?
No, in the Kamena Shoup paper, they have like halfway down the paper, they have some, let me find out.
No, that sounds familiar that they referred to that. Yeah.
So inequality, I mean, yeah, okay. They're in the in EPID paper, they have this, and that's what probably they're using for this K not equals to B.
Yeah. Yes, so I guess that's the protocol that they're taking out. All right, well, that mystery solved then.
Okay, but my understanding is that the reason we did not go with the signature-based revocation was, like in Anonymous 2.0, was that the signature, like if you enable signature through, enable revocation through signature, then it lets the verifier and issuer or whoever's in charge of doing the revocation collude and like somehow, if not learn the link secret, it won't learn the link secret, but it would be able to find out which holder it was. So that's the reason we did not do it. But I'll look into the paper more and tell you in the next few weeks.
Yeah, that would be interesting. I started sketching up this slide, but didn't get very deep into it. So it might be, I don't know if this is going to be useful or not, but I just starting to put together some just high level notions of what each protocol does. So you're trying to prove a certain thing using a certain technique. And so earlier this week, just taking a look at what Zcash did, but I think that the only relationship there is the use of a Merkle tree. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I didn't build this out the rest of the way, but if this line of thinking is useful to anybody else, then that might be something else to finish building out.
Okay. But I mean, really in Zcash, you don't get revocation. You're kind of proving that some serial number is not, or some value is already being used. So it's not revocation, but yeah, you can look at that line of parsing problem.
Yeah, there's not really a revocation in there, which is why I had to update the title of the slide.
Okay,
it's revocation-ish. Proofish.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's just a proof that a commitment exists in the Merkle tree versus a proof that something doesn't exist in a Merkle tree over here. I didn't quite get to the point of saying what wasn't in the list. But I guess something that would be helpful for me is if somebody wanted to go through and present the revocation stuff for a non-creds too. That would be interesting. then.
Okay, we can do this. I can tell you the basic idea right now is this. It's the same thing that you have a commitment. If you're proving that you have a commitment in the tree and revealing the leaf value. So the revocation, you like, what, let's say you decide if the leaf value is zero, the thing is revoked or not, right? So let's say you are saying that the leaf tree has value zero. Now you're proving in the non-creds proof that there is a leaf in the tree whose value is same. So when I say whose value means the leaf index really is corresponds to my credential ID, and that has value zero or non-zero, whatever you're proving. But that's the high-level idea of
the non-creds. Okay, and the leaf value itself is one if the credential is still valid and zero if it's revoked?
Yeah. Or whatever you decide, it doesn't make a difference, but yeah, that's right. So leaf index determines your credential ID.
You could think zero is not revoked, one is revoked. Just depends on what.
Mm-hmm. One more thing, Dan. You said that you might have this code for the BBS plus signatures, because from what I understand, this really would you would have a code for BBS plus signatures. What EPID is building on that and adding more predicates and adding stuff around it. So Is there a chance you can get us the code for the BBS plus signatures or the whole EPID?
Yeah, so there is some open source EPID stuff, but I wasn't able to confirm with the author what the intent and status of it is. So that person is on vacation until August 27th or something like that. So hopefully before our next meeting, I can say something more definitive about that. It's actually out there on GitHub. I just don't want to go point people at it just to find out later that that's not really meant to be a supported thing or it's limited in some way.
Okay.
You want to do? Yeah, I'm submitting the BBS Plus based off of some code I'm reconciling with Lavesh. Lavesh, I submitted a big PR to your repo to fix some things or address some things. So once you merge that, then I can.
Yeah, I didn't say you did. You had like fixed non-CS stuff. Like, what's non-CS? The title of the PR.
Non-constant time.
What was non-constant time about that?
I can't remember. I changed a bunch of things. There were some things that were non-constant time. So, but they are closer.
Okay. Because I could see a bunch of things and you like were renaming a lot of things. I kind of, that's why I go in detail. So, I have a look.
But anyway, yeah, I'm adapting so that we just have a common curve library, so that we don't have like three or four implementations, because I have an open PR for one. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if Lavesh is doing one, I'm doing one, makes sense to reconcile. So I went through Lavesh's and adjusted some things and tweaked some things so that now I could probably just end up closing that PR.
Okay. Can you tell me in chat or in GitHub, can you tell me like what's the non-constant stuff that you're removing or like you're changing?
Well, you can see it in the commit.
Okay, look, but all I saw was like some renaming, so I don't understand CS meant constant time, so.
Yeah.
Anyway, just, if it would be helpful if you just put it in the GitHub comment or ping in chat or exactly.
I'd have to look. I've been in so many places, but yeah, I could look, but yeah, if you go look in there and you see what the commit is, you go, oh, okay.
Okay, fine. I'll look.
Okay. I want to talk about some repo stuff real quick, but just concluding the EPID discussion, is there any last question?
I have a hard stop in 2 minutes.
So. Yeah. Hey, Dan.
Yeah.
Can I jump in real quick? I just want to let everybody know that the community architect team is, I guess cracking down is not the right term. We want to update all of the authorship stuff on any third-party module or parties. Modules and Ursa team has a number of crates. I've already talked to Mike Lauder. I'm just letting you guys know, so when you guys see the PRs coming through the Ursa thing to fix the metadata, that you guys don't freak out. We're just getting everything lined up to the existing authorship and copyright policies for Hyperledger. So if you go to crates.io and you go to like the Ursa crate, it should say Hyperledger Ursa community rather than individual developers. That's all I wanted to say.
Okay. And then, so if there's a published policy about that, you might want to just link that to people.
It's in our copyright policy.
Okay.
Can you just send out a brief email, Dave, maybe?
Sure, I'll do that. Yeah.
Thanks a lot.
So something else that's sort of related to that maybe is we want all of the repos across Hyperledger to have some consistency with things like maintainers. So I don't think we yet have a maintainers file or a code owners file. The code owners is like a sort of a metadata thing that GitHub can use. And so we can do better GitHub notifications using the code owners file. Like at least one thing that I'm familiar with for that is that when somebody opens a PR, it'll automatically add the people listed in code owners as reviewers for that PR. And that helps prevent the problem where somebody puts up a PR, particularly if they're somebody new to the community, they put up a PR and they don't have a way to assign reviewers, and then it just sits there. And then the maintainers file just makes it explicit who the maintainers are. That is not like a strictly structured thing from a GitHub perspective, but it might be in the future. So what I would suggest that we do with a maintainers file is that we initialize it with the names from the Ursa project proposal, which listed maintainers in it. And then we can add commits or subsequent PRs that add in anybody who needs to be or should be a maintainer after that. And we should probably also have some sort of policy around that. Like one that we use in Sawtooth is just that the existing maintainers all unanimously agree to add or remove somebody. And that brings us to the end of time. So maybe we could have more discussion on that because we didn't really have time to discuss that, but at least initialize that.
Yeah. Thanks, Dan. Thanks for your talk on Epid as well.
Yeah.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks, everyone. And we will talk to you in a couple of weeks, if not sooner. So thanks and have a great day.